listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
And Elwyn Poole is back with me to talk about his latest set of data just published about academic achievement for school leavers in secondary schools around the country. Elwyn, this is an annual report. And I guess the thing that stands out to me, very obviously, is that the most successful schools in New Zealand academically are girls' schools, and usually they're private schools. Is that a fair comment?
Yes. The girls are well ahead of the boys. It's not just private schools. I mean, I guess one of the most startling stats, if you wanted to sort of grab someone with a front pager, is that for university entrance for leavers, and the leavers data is the most important. It takes a while for education counts to put it together, but it's the one that says, how's a school doing with every student that started there and every student that started last year? You can't fudge it. And so one of the ones I look at, there's a few stats there, but is university entrance for leavers. And for the top 40 schools, they see 87% of their students leave with university entrance, which is our top school qualification. It's not necessarily about going to university, but it is about having choices. And that's how you should go into adulthood. For our bottom 40 schools, it's 2.7%. In that top 40, yes, girls' schools predominate. There are private, there are a couple of full state schools, and there are a number of integrated schools. And I think it's always interesting how well schools like St. Joseph Māori Girls, Manakura do, because to me, they show the way for Māori education. And there's a couple of others there that do that too. So they kind of take away the excuses. They're lower decile, they're full Māori, and they succeed very, very well.
But the reality is that for 2023, the top achieving schools for NCEA Level 3, Iona College in Havelock North, private, Ngātahua Diocesan School, Martin, private, Barradine College in Remuera in Auckland, that was Catholic, but I presume it's now integrated, is it?
It's a state integrated, yep.
Yeah, not fully private. Samuel Marsden, private. St Cuthbert's in Epsom, private. Christchurch Adventist School, I imagine, is what, integrated? Or is that private as well? Run by the Adventist Church, I would imagine. Yep. Diocesan School for Girls, private. And the top boys' school is also private, Hutt International Boys' School.
Yeah, so that's Hutt International, now a state integrated, but it started as a private school.
Yeah, so the pattern is there, isn't it? What I'm asking is, whereabouts are the great old traditional boys' high schools, the places that I went to, like Waitaki Boys' High School, way, way down the list. But even Auckland Grammar, Wellington College, Christchurch Boys' High School. We hear plenty about their rugby prowess, not hearing too much about their academic prowess, Elwyn.
So, I mean, first thing I'd say, I taught first Tauranga Boys, Hamilton Boys, so I know the schools, I know the situations that you're talking about. Then I went and taught at St. Cuthbert's College for 4 years. And one of my first experiences was, because at Tauranga Boys I was coaching the first 15, I was coaching athletics, and so, you know, the guys would stop after class and they'd want to talk about sport, which was cool, and I thought that was relatively normal. When I started at St. Cuth's and I was teaching seventh form economics, at the end of the period I'd have girls come up and say, well, you know how you were talking about aggregate demand, I was wondering what the and I'm thinking, you know, is this?
I get what you're saying.
Is this a practical joke? Yeah, and just their diligence was incredible. And I'd have to also say, I think the sheer intent of the staff to see all children succeed And I had children in my classes who I think if they hadn't been at a school like St. Cuthbert's, really wouldn't have had a chance. But the sheer drive, I then had the experience of my two boys went to Auckland Grammar. They both absolutely thrived academically, but they didn't do it in the so-called grammar way. Both of them were very good sports people who had national sports events at the end of each term. And so they actually began the year studying for Cambridge at the end of the year. And crazily enough, I mean, they averaged all the time in the 90s. They went down a class often because they didn't put any emphasis on the grammar way. And so they thrived despite being at Auckland Grammar to some extent. I also asked them at the end of that time, how many good teachers did you have? And over 10 years, they counted five. My daughter then went to Epsom Girls, and the experience again was remarkably different. And I went to the teacher interviews. If I went to grammar, they didn't even know who my children were. When I went to Epsom Girls, they were really detailed. And so I don't think it's just to say girls' schools per se. They work really hard. And whether that's come out of 20, 25 years ago where things need to change and they've just accelerated through. And I might have mentioned this one to you, but one day teaching at Tauranga Boys, when we were going through academic results, the head of English stood up and said, "Well, as opposed to math and science, our results are behind the national average for English. But you must remember, we are teaching boys." And again, I looked around thinking, "What on earth would C.S. Lewis make of that?"
Yeah. I mean, it's just a dreadful excuse, isn't it?
Oh, it's a terrible excuse, but it's pervasive. And it's made society wide. And people will say things like, "Well, it's caused by the feminization of teaching." Well, nonsense. I mean, it's deeper than that. And broadly, it's sort of excuse making. And I think you've hit the nail on the head pretty early. We emphasize things that make a school look good externally. And having a successful first 15, or having a Māori Cup rowing team, or these sorts of things are the things that kind of make a lot of schools wow. And I often think about St. Peter's and Epsom. Now, they're normally in the 90s. They've got an excellent principal in James Bentley. And he gets the starter set. He said, "We knew we'd take a little bit of a hit because this, and this happened." So it's really analytical. But they're an example for every boys' school. They're not a private school. They're state integrated. They weren't a tenth decile school. They always achieve in that top group academically. They do Cambridge, as do some of those schools that aren't doing so well. And their sports teams do well too. As are their cultural pursuits. So there are really good examples.
Yeah, and literally they live in the shadow of grammar because they are right across the motorway, right across Mountain Road, from Auckland Grammar, aren't they? So they see Auckland Grammar every day.
And they shine above them, to be
Yeah.
honest.
Well, talking of grammar, this to me is perhaps the most astounding statistic in your survey about level three NCEA achievement. Auckland Grammar in 2023, only 71.9% of their leavers achieved level three NCEA. That's down from 81% in 2020 and 82.3% in 2018. So, in 6 years, Alwyn, Auckland Grammar, the Great Auckland Grammar, with over 2,000 boys, has gone from 82.3% of its leavers achieving NCEA level three 6 years ago to 72% in 2023. Astounding.
Yeah, I would tend to look at their university entrance statistic more because they are a Cambridge school. So if you've got the spreadsheet in front of you, go to the kind of next page. They are, I think, sitting at about 74%, so slightly above their level three for UE because of their Cambridge situation. So there's a few schools there who have kind of
Yeah,
got.
they're at 73.8, but again, Elwin, for UE. That's 2023. The number from 2018 is 76.8. So they're still dropping, and the pattern is that, well, they've dropped from 78.9, so nearly 79% in what year's column J, 2021, down to 74% 2 years later.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have an easy explanation for that. But you're right, it doesn't look to be a good situation. And you mentioned Christchurch Boys. I have a look, again, being a former First 15 coach and having taught at two of the Super 8 schools in the North Island. So the Super 8 schools are Tauranga, Hamilton, Rotorua, Napier, New Plymouth, Palmerston North, Gisborne. Why do I always miss one out?
Hastings in there with Napier?
Hastings, that's it. Now, I think the top university entrance for leavers amongst those schools is 48% at Hamilton Boys. You're down to 14% for Rotorua Boys. And that's where this data is so honest. Because
15.1 at Hastings, by the way, for last year.
15.1?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's where the start was so honest, because earlier in the year, Rotorua Boys put out, because their principal got a King's Award, to say that, you know, 95% of their student, their level three students got NCA level three, and that there was no outcome difference between their Māori and European students. Well, yes, for that cohort, but they're losing over 30% of their students before they turn 17. And so you can fudge that cohort data and you can say, wow, we're amazing. But when you dig down and you say, well, hang on a second. And I think that's the kind of honesty that we need. And that's why, I'm delighted. The number of schools who are buying this data set, because it's a lot of work and there is a sort of charge associated for schools, and then engaging with it and going, okay, how do we set goals for all of our students? And who do we engage with? And I've said it to people a few times. When I first started doing this set about 5 years ago, one of the standout schools was Manukura. And so I thought, how do they do that? So I contacted Nathan Jury.
So this is in Palmerston North, isn't it,
Manukura? Yes. And I said, okay. Can I have a conversation? You know, how are you doing this? What are these remarkable achievements? And so we went through this sort of history, and he's an amazing guy to talk to. Nathan and Yvette are about to rebegin St. Stephen's in Pukekohe. And he said, well, first of all, we don't compromise. Secondly, the Jury family, through I think his great grandfather, I'd have to check on that, going to university and then saying, look, everyone's going to. And Nathan himself decided not to. He went off shearing and came back a year later and said, that university thing. And they take all of their kids to Otago every year to the health sciences. They get a lot of kids who then go through health sciences. And they just, there's no excuse for Māori. We can thrive, we can achieve, we can do that in context. But the thing about that was, we had this conversation, then I said, Nathan, you must be inundated with people who want to know, you know, the secret sauce. And he said, you're the first.
So yeah. I presume Nathan is from the same family as Eddie Jury and Mason Jury, the
correct.
Yep. Legal scholars, judges, yep. Lawyers, et cetera. Yeah.
So, and they're passing that on to, you know, a whole group, a whole new sort of generation who are going through their school in Palmerston North.
So tell me, Owen, this is the important thing. So they've now left Palmerston North, they've left Manukura, gone to Tipperary, St. Stephen's, which is yet to start, but I understand that's imminent in the next year or so. What has happened at Manukura since they left?
My understanding is it's really positive still. So I'm even communicating with Nathan. I was communicating with Nathan this morning. And to me, these are templates. What do
So what you're
you
saying, it's
think?
not necessarily people, it's systems and attitudes.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. And, even with the sort of middle schools I've designed, I've always thought that a really good model, a really good system and approach can turn a good teacher into a great teacher, and an adequate teacher into a very good teacher. And I think that that's what that does. A lot of it in these schools, and I think it's really highlighted in the boys' schools, there's a very early categorization as to the nature of the student. Is the person, are they an athlete or are they an academic? And in some cases, it's really stark. Or are they neither? So we really don't bother with them. They're not going to achieve academically. Goodness, they're not going to achieve in the sporting field. And I don't think that's acceptable. There will be literally thousands of kids of all ethnicities and all demographics who don't show early potential, and that could be about the environment they've been brought up in so far, and consciously or subconsciously written off, because they're not going to add anything to the school's reputation, and it's a big deal.
Yeah, well, I remember that sort of attitude prevailing at my school. And that's what, back in the 1960s and early 70s. But there was always the tech block, you see, Elwin.
Yep.
They went off to woodwork and metalwork. And the ex expectation, I guess, was that those guys would leave school at 15 or 16 and go and pick up a trade. Indeed, many of them did. Many of them were my cohort. And many of them had become very successful in those
Yep.
trades over the last half century.
And that's a really, really good pathway. But it's not a good pathway to define people early to. And I think the second thing about that pathway, becoming, let's say, a very good plumber, and we had one in our home yesterday, it's a high expectations job. And, to go through to do the qualifications, if you're going to go on and run it as a business, running a small business is complex, and
You gotta know
become.
how to add and subtract, don't you, for a start?
Well, absolutely. And so again, I think that a step off point, and if you were going to employ an apprentice, a step off point into an apprenticeship is a year 13 qualification now. And so it's no good saying, well, he's 15, he can go off and do a trade. Well, no, he's not going to be able to go off and do a trade. He's going to hold a stop go sign. And even those guys can't make mistakes. I tried to go through one the other day when both ends were on go.
Yeah. Well, what do we do about schools down the bottom of your list? I'm looking at UE because you mentioned that before as
Yep.
a level of academic achievement shows that people have not necessarily passed grad exams or they want to go to university, but it says that they have done a reasonable amount at high school. Yep, we look down the bottom, there are schools with zero passes last year for UE, and I'm looking at Coromandel Area School, for instance. There's some schools there that I don't know where Whangarei College is. I suspect that's up north. Edgecumbe College in the Eastern Bay of Plenty. No
Yeah.
students reaching UE in 2023. But even going into the cities, Tamaki College in East Auckland, 2.6% of leavers. Tongariro School, 2.1%. Porirua College in Wellington, less than 4%, 3.9%. What are those schools thinking about that low level of achievement? Are they worried about it?
Well, I think you would have to be. And, I've deliberately gone and visited schools at those sort of levels. I went to one of them. I went to Whanganui City College, which was Whanganui Boys College. And first of all, it is tough, but you said what to do about it, and they need a mechanism for improvement. And so out of this data set, and there's a couple of schools in that range that I'm working with, out of this data set, we are looking at having goals where the school can progress against them. And so that's first of all your attendance, and you know, for a lot of these schools, their attendance is very low in terms of that sort of engagement. And I put a piece up on KiwiBlog the other day, and those what would have been decile one and two schools, high schools, you know, they're down around 30% of their students fully attending. So first of all, they've got to get them there. That's a big deal. I think the second thing actually is to go to parental engagement, and say how do we get our community back involved and aspirational in the school? That's pretty important. And then you go to your setting goals for your level one, your level two, your level three, your UE, and that school's not going to become St. Peter's overnight. But they have to have something to get their kids out of bed, their staff out of bed, their parents motivated. And to have these sort of goals in place is a really good option. The next thing is, well, they go hand in hand. It's not the next thing. But staffing is so incredibly important. And currently under the collective contract, there is no way for a school, you mentioned Porirua, we need those others, there's no way for them to incentivize good teachers to come and teach at their school. So they will have a significant number of people there who are absolutely trying their guts out. And some of them will be doing exceedingly well. They'll be known as good teachers. The school can't do anything to say, hey, well done. They can't do anything to, I don't know, let's say a really good head of maths at Wellington College to say, hey, come and teach at Porirua. We will give you a $20,000 a year increment to help you in this situation to really boost what we're doing in math. And that's where the collective contract is a huge handicap. You just can't incentivize. And so
this school, there were things put in place by various ministers of education which allowed for incentive payments for for above average teachers. Did they never come to fruition in the end?
Yeah, a little, but they're relatively minor, you know, compared to the change that would be required in that situation. So I would imagine that, you know, a highly successful HOD at a school that's doing very well, it's a neat job. And there would be, you know, a lots of sense of you're doing good things, you're in the right place. I mean, when I left St. Cuth's, it was a tough call because I really enjoyed it. I was head of commerce. We were living on site, etc. But I ended up wandering down to Linda Reed, a very good principal, and just said, Linda, I'm leaving. And she said, pardon? And I said, well, you know, frankly, a trained monkey could do my job here.
Because the kids were so attentive, so receptive to your teaching. You're saying is there was no challenge for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was an academic challenge. I mean, teaching these year 13 girls, you know, one or two of them who were topping the country and are now very prominent business people, was an academic challenge. But I was making a marginal difference. So I felt a little less satisfied than I wanted to be as a teacher, even though it was a very good teaching situation. And so for some people, that incentive is a little different. You've got to say, okay, you've got a family, et cetera, to sort of uproot and go and teach in this school that's struggling. Here's a significant incentive to get on with it. And that's a big deal. Leadership in schools is incredibly important. But you've got to have good teachers under that leadership too.
Mm. So since the change of government, we've had a new Minister of Education who seems hell-bent on raising standards. We know the much talked about hour a day of the basics at primary school level of reading, writing and arithmetic. But nothing seems to have changed much at either the union level or at the ministry level. Talks about personnel changes at the ministry, but I think Iona Halstead is still there for now, isn't she? She might be not having her contract renewed. But certainly at union level, nothing appears to have changed. They seem as entrenched as ever, pushing back against new teaching ideas, about new curriculum. You know, it's an uphill battle for anybody in the education system when you have those attitudes, isn't it?
Look, I think Erica's trying really hard, and I think she's already done some good things. I think she would be aware that I would love those secondary school goals there. Heke Parata, I think, got it. And she, again, was trying very hard. She got it wrong, I think, by setting a blunt axe goal of 85% of level two in CEA for every high school. But it did lift things. It just also involved some gaming. So I like the progression goals, and I think every high school should have them, and I'd love them to have them at the beginning of next year. I mean, it's a stroke of a pen, really. And, you know, but Erica's trying really hard, and some of the things that she's done are very good. Iona is leaving. I have actually applied for her job. I give myself about a 1 in 2,000 chance, but I think I would do a good job because I don't think they need another bureaucrat in there.
What do you think your odds are so long, Elwin?
Well, I'm not a public servant, and I've been...
That doesn't matter. People have come in to run government departments before from the private sector, unquote, but you've got experience in the sector.
Yeah, it has been a bit of a public sector merry-go-round, though. But I also can rub people up the wrong way. But honestly, I think our system needs that desperately. And the ministry needs that. I mean, it's 4,000 people when it used to be, you know, much, much less. Even 6 or 7 years ago, it was 2,700. It has to be run more efficiently. I know people within the ministry, good people within the ministry, who are deeply frustrated by the bullying, by the incompetence, by the pushback against change, all of those kinds of things. And the ministry, it's not axial at the moment because it's irrelevant, but it could be axial. And I mean, the first thing that someone like me ought to do is send out a survey to every principal in New Zealand and say, what can we do for you to improve the situation? Because at the moment, all of the compliance is in the other direction. Mm. What can we do for you? What's your experience with us at present? And that's a big start. That you, I mean, Kieran Fui, who's a very good former principal of St. Peter's and St. Paul's in Ponsonby, you know, he just says, as many principals do, the ministry needs to be repurposed. The unions, I think their approach is appalling. I saw one of the sort of top union execs on a Pacific radio station the other day, and I followed him yesterday, you know, basically saying, and the discussion there was charter schools, but basically saying, well, you know, things aren't that bad. Now, they are. They're terrible. And they're really terrible for Māori and Pacific students. And, you know, one of their sort of mantras is, we already have choice in New Zealand. We do. We have choice for Catholic students, and we have choice for wealthy students. But even our zoning, the effect of that now is to keep students who would struggle out of so-called good schools. It's not a ring fence in. It's a barrier out in many situations. So a lot of the Māori Pacifica, I mean, as I said to this radio station yesterday, if I was Māori Pacific, I'd be on the street every day about the education outcomes for our children. And we just take them as normal. So, I mean, the overall UE pass rate for Māori leavers in New Zealand is 17%. It's 62.
And I noticed that down the road, and I've said this, I think, to you before, Huntly College, very close to the headquarters of Waikato Tainui,
yep,
got a $2 billion operation now, Waikato Tainui, incredibly wealthy. Huntly, smack bang in the middle of that iwi's area, their level three NCEA achievement rate is something like 2%. It's extraordinarily poor.
It is.
That's not taking into account those who leave before they get to level three.
Agreed. And that's a big deal. Also, we tend to think of education for Māori as being in schools, as I mentioned, like St. Joseph Māori Girls Manukura. The truth is, as I said, half of the Māori students in single-sex boys' education are in those Super 8 schools. It's a huge amount. The three biggest schools for Māori in New Zealand are Tauranga Boys, Rotorua Boys, and Hamilton Girls, except for Correspondence School. And one of the most remarkable things in that stats is in the last 2 years, Correspondence School, so it's under, it's quite a way down, but they've gone from 6,000 students to 8,000 students, and it's again predominantly Māori, and the outcomes are appalling.
Wow. So, yes, I did see that school there with the big roll.
Yes.
And it used to be known as the Correspondence School, but correct, of course it's now got a name that I wouldn't necessarily recognise, a Te Reo name. That's just fine. But, yeah, the achievement is not high. But does that include kids doing homeschooling? Because it seems to me that there's quite a push to that too, isn't there?
There are over 10,000 students now in homeschools. That's gone up significantly. And we've also got to remember we've got 10,000 kids enrolled nowhere. and so to me, that's why this situation is actually so desperate. And I have huge regard for Cameron Bagri, because a lot of our politicising, our economics, and that is always talking about the adult situation, of course, because as one prominent national politician once said to me, well, kids don't vote. And we also had the situation for a very long time where, let's say, two-thirds of our school students were doing okay, you know, maybe you can argue 75%. And so, of course, you had 75% of families who would go, well, you know, this education thing's not a big deal. Cameron's a lot smarter than that. And says, well, it is a big deal.
Because... Well, he went to Waitaki Boys High School, you see, so that helps.
Right. Yes, of course. Only two. I mean, I think Michael Laws and I count ourselves as the only people who came out of Oranguru City College or Oranguru Boys that have done well, but of course that's not true either. But, you know, Cameron says the way that we should see our economy and our society in 20 years' time is how our education system is doing now. And it's a big deal.
Yeah, and you talk about the young women you taught at St. Cuthbert's in commerce. You taught them economics. They were bright, and you knew that they would do well. And you added to their academic achievement, and there they are.
That's right. And
in New Zealand commerce.
And the opposite is there's a young man that I look after a little bit when I can in Hamilton, and he has been living for the last 2 years in a, you know, he's a bit of a naughty boy. He's been living in a home. His education is completely on hold. He's under a rangatamariki. He's costing $100,000 a year. And we have thousands of those, let alone the fact, you know, in the far north, we have 21% of 18 to 25s who are NEETs, not in education, employment, or training. And it's not just the, well, I mean, I suppose when you work out the cost of that, you do both ends. You say this is the money it costs up front. And I hope also they look at the fact that they don't contribute in terms of sort of paying tax, employment, that sort of thing. So it's a really big deal. And so the situation now isn't, oh, well, we need to tweak this and tweak that. It's a huge, huge problem. And comparative to other OECD countries, it's a terrible problem.
But having said that, Owen, you've talked about the influence of the unions.
Yes.
Their seeming intransigence. You hear about education in Britain. You hear about education in the United States and in Australia. So the countries that we associate closest with, I guess, or compare ourselves most of the time with. it seems that their education sector unions are just as powerful, just as influential, and just as resistant to change as the NZEI and the PPTA are in this country. Is that true?
I think that there's some accuracy in that. The difference here is, and I'm going to say until Erica, because you know she'll have a lot to do, and I think there are things that are urgent that haven't been done yet. But let's say until Erica, we haven't really had the political will to disrupt things.
Well, Lockwood Smith tried to, didn't he, with bulk funding whenever that was years ago. He tried to.
Absolutely. And so that's a big deal. I think in Britain, it doesn't matter whether it's Labour or the Conservatives. In the US, I mean, of course, Barack Obama had his really well-intentioned, and it did make a difference, No Child Left Behind. In Australia, one of the things that has pushed things along in the last few years has been really the competition between the states, because no one likes to be seventh, and it leads to all sorts of jokes about people who live in Tasmania, which is unfair, of course. But in New Zealand, we haven't had yet the political will. I think also one of the really big problems here, and you would have probably been aware of the ERA report that came out recently about just how far behind a lot of our five-year-olds are when they arrive at school. And we have a huge, huge issue with our under-five parenting. And, you know, one of the conversations that I had prior to her being minister with Erica Stanford and with many others was that we desperately need, and people's the back of, here on the back of their neck prick up on this a bit, but I think we need a crown entity for parenting. I think it needs to be incredibly well designed and defined to be non-interventional. And to be about how a child develops and not ideologies about child development. But, you know, we need it to be absolutely pervasive through our society. For instance, how a woman behaves when she's pregnant, because fetal alcohol syndrome is a lot easier to prevent than it is to treat and cure. And so it just should be pervasive. I mean, a bit like smoking in the car. If a woman's pregnant, you don't drink alcohol. You don't drink any alcohol. You know, you're pretty moderate on coffee. You're trying to avoid stress. Clearly, you don't do meth or marijuana and these sorts of things. But you've got to put the positives in there as well. So if you're going to do a whole lot of knots, what do you do? And so, look, you eat well, you make sure you get rest and relaxation, you exercise, you do all of these kinds of things. And then from the moment the child's born, how do you care for a child? Now, for a lot of people who are listening today, they go, well, everyone knows that. They don't. And they haven't seen it. You know, I got brought up in a pretty tough home. I had tremendous benefit to meet a family who were really remarkable, and to go, okay, goodness, this is new and different. They actually read to their kids and all that sort of stuff. And so, I mean, I read to my children every night on the basis of seeing another family do that. If you don't think that that's something that people do, then you're not going to do it. If you're not a good reader yourself, you're going to be embarrassed about it, but you actually become a good reader by doing it. And so we need something that tells every parent in New Zealand who will all love their kids. You know, people, oh, no, some of them just don't. Well, they do. They don't know how. They're probably stressed. They've probably been brought up badly themselves. They haven't got role models. They've probably got someone in their life who could be violent. We've got a lot of solo mums. We've got a few solo dads. And they really do need support. Not to be told their baby factories and all this sort of stuff, which people tend to do. You've got to really get behind our parenting.
So what you're suggesting, Owen, is we need leadership, and because the people that you've been referring to are sadly in many instances Maori. We surely need iwi leadership to be making comments and showing the appropriate signs in this area, don't we? We certainly need political leadership, and I'm not seeing too much of that from this government or from the government before them and the government before them, sort of thing. So, I mean, what I see is just it's almost a laissez-faire attitude from our leadership class, for want of a better word, that they just let people get on with it. There's not a lot of good advice going around. It's not just education, it's not just parenting, it's in health as well. The answer to everything, Elwin, seems to be more money. Let's throw more money at it. We know, surely we know by now, that does not work.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we missed many beats with the COVID intervention. But one of them was clearly saying that people who were healthier and who got a lot of exercise were less likely to get more sick. So how about doing some exercise? But we're in these situations where all sorts of organisations believe that they're the cure for something, so they put their hands out for money. And people getting on and doing it themselves doesn't help that organisation, of course. And I think that's highly problematic. But also government think that they're a cure. They have to be. They have to say something like, and I think the literacy and numeracy programs have real merit, but they have to be able to say, we fixed it. Whereas in the situation, if you got every parent of children, let's say under 10, reading on the majority of the nights each week, that is going to bring a much more significant improvement to our literacy and children actually being literate than these in-school programs. And particularly, as you say, because there's pushback and there'll be different levels of provision according to a whole range of factors in schools. But a child, a parent sitting down and reading Dr. Seuss to their kids and then going on to sort of Roald Dahl or any you know, books like that, the kid is going to learn to read through modelling and then may need some expert help at school as well to move on. But that's not a government fix, you see. And so I think that's a bit problematic, but it is the fix. We need a huge improvement in parenting in New Zealand, not just for schooling, but for behaviours, for respect for older people, you know, for all sorts of things that make up a good society.
Elwin, we have to talk about charter schools before we finish this conversation.
Yeah.
You know, David Seymour has put some money aside for the formation of them. I understand there's been a lot of applications to be charter schools or whatever the new name for them is going to be. And that includes a lot of current state schools who want to change their funding model. For a start, is there enough money in the pot to have everybody become an independently organized school? Or is there going to be needing more money from the government for this to happen, for everybody who wants to become an independent school to be able to fulfill their wishes?
Well, again, going back to the kind of humour of the unions, I know that if someone wandered in here and put a suitcase down and here's $153 million, I think it's a lot of money. Mm. In terms of the actual amount it is of our education spend, it's less than 1%. And, you know, the unions, et cetera, saying, well, if you spread this money throughout the system, you'll solve everything. It would provide a third of a teacher aide for every school in New Zealand. And so, it again, at this stage, it's a really minor intervention, but it's an important intervention, and it ought to be something that is seen to grow and develop. I have formed a really good new charitable company with some remarkable people. We've applied for four. And we think they are very good applications, but like everyone else, we have to wait to see where we get to in the approval process. I think 78 applications is good. It's a lot tougher sometimes than people think. It's actually not easy just going in and setting up a school. The establishment funding is about 3% of a state school establishment fund at an estimate. So you have to do some pretty smart things. We've got four very, very good property owners behind us in terms of providing facilities for lease. You know, they're not necessarily easy to find. So it will be an interesting process.
I'm intrigued by the state schools that want to change.
Yeah.
Their boards, one imagine, would have approved the application. I wonder what their staff, particularly their unionized staff, think about the schools making the application. Do you actually know which state schools have applied?
I don't. Angela Roberts was a Labor MP, fortunately not for too long. She was previously head of the PPTA.
Correct,
yes. And when one of the schools that I established last time, South Auckland Middle School, was really thriving, she said, well, of course they're thriving. They're bulk funded. And I nearly fell off my chair because, you know, the PPTA are so proud of defeating bulk funding. And so I think that that's the mechanism that these schools will be seeing. And there's also a neat thing that happens when a school gets a chance to kind of start again. And it's like you clear the table and you go, right, what can we do differently here? I mean, the unions are saying, well, you know, this is just a union busting thing. And it sort of says that you don't have to be a part of the collective agreement. When we formed charter schools last time, some of our teachers were coming out of the, well, they weren't coming out of the end. Some of the teachers were union members. When they went into our schools, the unions banned them from union membership. I mean, the level of hypocrisy is unbelievable. So I would think that these schools, you're right, to put through an application, there must have been some, maybe a high level of engagement. I don't know whether they necessarily would have let all of their staff and community know just yet. It is a two-staged application process. So 78 applications have gone in. I assume they're being evaluated at the moment.
There's about 30-something state schools, aren't there?
No, I think it was less than that. I think it was around 10.
Okay.
But that will be a toe in the water. You know, kind of see how it goes. But you're right. It's an uncomfortable thing when you've got a staff room that's split. I mean, I had a very good friend who contacted me when teachers were mandated out in COVID. And by the way, I handed in my teacher's registration 1 minute after that was done by Minister Hipkins because as a former principal, I could never ask my teachers about health. And about their medical situation. Couldn't even ask them if they wanted to have a baby at some stage in the future. And all of a sudden, this was something that was incredibly important. And I said to the Teachers' Council, I want to know if my teachers are sick. I don't care whether they're vaccinated or not, because it's only when they're sick that that's an issue. But, you know, one principal sort of contacted me and said, look, I've got to let go a person who has made an incredible contribution to our school over 40 years. And my inner response was, I was supportive, but my inner response was, well, if 10 schools got together of your size and said, get stuffed, it would have been very different. So I knew the tension that created in a lot of schools, and I think that's something a school becoming a charter school from a state situation is going to have to. But keep in mind also, Peter, that some of those schools that are state schools and are wanting to become charter schools, some of them may well be previous charter schools that became state integrated or designated.
Sure.
I don't know how many of them are long-term state schools.
Okay. Elwyn, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We've once again covered a wide range of topics are very appropriate in today's educational environment. The pushback by government has begun. I know it's got a long, long way to go, but it can only surely be onwards and upwards from here, because we don't want those educational attainment standards to drop any lower, do we?
No, and look, I've got a lot of belief in the desire of Erica Stanford to do very, very good things. I still think there are some tough choices to make. I think she will see that. I think she needs a really good secretary for education, and I can think of someone. But also, it's important for people to be informed. I mean, if people want that leavers data set, they are really welcome to email me at elwyn.paul@gmail.com. And a lot of people do, and they get it, and they're astounded. But it's also motivating. You can see the schools that are doing well, and you can think about, how to help your children if they're in a tough situation.
Very good. Yes, you'd be suggesting send your daughter to Iona College. Don't send any of your children to Northland or Huntley College.
It's tough, and it's really tough in the far north. And that's true. People who have wealth send their children somewhere else. And so, improve the schools, you'll get those children back.
Nice talking with you, Alwyn. I'm sure
Thanks,
we'll do it.
Peter. Okay, bye.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.